I want you to know that I have mixed feelings about sharing this with you. I interviewed a social worker who works as an addictions counselor. That's her job. And as we got into the conversation, I realized that I didn't agree with what she was saying. And so this interview goes in directions that you will not expect, and some strange things happen. And while this is, you know, good radio, because it's got some awkward bits and some twists and turns that you don't expect, it's also a bit difficult to hear. I'm giving you this long preface because I want you to listen to the whole thing, because if you just listen to the first 5 or 6 minutes, you will miss what happens in this audio. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll just cut it and I'll just put the good bits together, but then you won't see what happens as it evolves. Like, how do I get from A to B to C, and how does she get from C to D to E, and what I'm sharing more than I normally would, and I'm sharing some things that, frankly, I'm worried about you hearing, because there's some of the content in here that's not triggering, but just completely counter to what you often hear me say. So with that very large grain of salt, may I suggest 2 things. Number one, that you are kind, to consider it kindly from both what I say and what she says. And number two, that you think about what you've heard me say before and how this resonates with you, and whether or not you agree with me or whether or not you agree with her, because in fact we end up disagreeing. I want you to hear the whole thing, because I think it ends in a place where you don't expect. Okay, ready? This is Belle speaking, and I'm doing a podcast today where I have invited a guest to be with us. Are you there?
I am here.
You are a licensed clinical social worker, and I've invited you to be on this call because you're a genius.
Well, I'm so glad somebody finally realizes it.
Don't you think? tell me, what is it that you do for a living, and what is your particular genius?
Oh, sure. So, like you said, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm also a licensed addiction counselor. And what I'm doing right now is counseling in private practice. But for about 10 years before I switched over to private practice, I'd been working in the substance abuse field. I started off doing many years in outpatient and then did a brief stint in inpatient before I switched over to private practice.
Okay. And so the range of people that you have worked with in terms of age might be?
Oh, let's see. 13 to 70s, 80s.
And is it always alcohol in your case, or all different kinds of addiction?
Oh, all different kinds. Of course, alcohol is the most prevalent because it's the most easily accessible. It's legal. But we see a lot of opiate addiction. Meth has kind of come back on the scene. And then also benzodiazepines, cocaine, but not as much.
Okay. But my understanding, too, though, is that with drugs, with hard drugs, if you don't sort it quickly, it kills you. Whereas with alcohol, it can let you live a really long time in a shitty place.
And you know what? I work with people that found a way to live in that shitty place for a long time with a lot of different things going on. Like, you know, maybe I have like a phase of just alcohol, or maybe got like a bad boyfriend and mixed in some meth and other drugs. But yeah, anytime you start mixing, what happens is what we in the biz call a synergistic effect, which means that the effects of the alcohol increase the effect of whatever else you're taking. So when you see, like, you know, these overdoses in the news, it 9 times out of 10, what you're going to see is it's a mix. It's a cocktail. It's somebody that was drinking while taking anti-anxiety meds and pain meds and sleep meds, and mixed all together, it just blasts the central nervous system and shuts the body down.
Right. And I want to perhaps stay away from worst case scenarios, because they tend to lend the feeling that since I'm not that person, none of this will apply to me.
Oh, exactly, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't shot up yet. I'm not an addict,
right.
Or I've never, you know, left my kids to go buy alcohol, I don't have a problem. Yeah, that's such an insidious way of detaching from the seriousness of one's condition and one's life.
Right. So if we stick specifically to alcohol, the kinds of things that you would do in a session with somebody who comes to you and says, I've got an issue with overdrinking, your approach might range from what's called harm reduction in the drinking world, well, in the drug and treatment world, all the way up to some kind of abstinence or rehab. Is that what your practice has been like?
Yes, and it was kind of freeing because the programs that I worked with were abstinence-based programs because that's, I mean, those are the programs that get the state and federal funding. They've got a lot of great research behind them, but it was a whole different experience going in private practice and working with people who are more what we'd call internally motivated, which means that they're seeking services not just because they're in legal trouble or their marriage is like really on the rocks, but because, yeah, they, like you said, say, I've got a problem with drinking. You're maybe the first person I've talked to about it, or I figured it out when this happened this last weekend. And so in the first session, I'll do exactly what you said, is kind of explain the different treatment approaches to talk with the person about what works or what might work the best for them in their particular situation with what resources and supports they've got available.
Mm-hmm. And do you only suggest, this is a trick question. I am setting you up. I'm telling you that in advance because I like you. Do you only talk about abstinence-based programs, or do you try to help people to moderate?
I absolutely, along with the abstinence-based, talk in length about what you might call harm reduction or even medication-assisted therapy. It's really, for me, it's whatever works to improve a person's life, health, relationships, and overall joy.
Do you know why that was a trick question?
Because so much of the, the recovery world, right? Like even, the 12 steps created back in the 30s, has been so focused on abstinence only, and a drug is a drug is a drug, and you've got to quit everything at once, or else you are still living a life of wreckage and disorder, and you are powerless, and your life is unmanageable forever until you complete pee clean.
And okay.
I don't know if that was a longer answer or a shorter answer. I tend to get a little bit sassy when I think about the rigidity of the abstinence treatment.
Right, and so then this is the point in the interview where things are going to get awkward. Because my program is abstinence only.
Mm-hmm.
And I might challenge that unless you have the over-drinking voice, the ideas of moderation aren't possible. They're not possible. They're not achievable. And we spend so much energy and time and frustration and time and energy and thinking about drinking that it's easier to have none than it is to think that moderation is a possibility.
Oh, absolutely. And I completely agree with you. Like, and this is where, like, I get to live in the dialectic of abstinence only is not the best fit or maybe unrealistic for some people, and is the safest if we're talking about alcohol, if you're going into withdrawals, definitely seek medical help because alcohol withdrawal will kill you. But after that, once you've entered medical safety, abstaining from everything, unless it's prescribed by a doctor and you're taking it as prescribed, is the healthiest, safest way to remove, illicit or unhealthy substances from your life.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is it's also easier.
Absolutely, right? And I love the way you describe it, like with Wolfie, right? If the answer is just no, that is way easier. It takes a lot less brain energy than no, unless I'm at my cousin's wedding and I can only have two, and then I have to drink two glasses of water between each one. I mean, that is so much mental energy that would be better served towards what would make me happy in this moment, or who can I go talk to instead of thinking about should I have I had too much, how many ounces, blah, 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 blah. I completely agree with you. Mm-hmm. It is so much easier to just, no, not an option. You shut that back door.
Then what stops you from only presenting that to clients? Like, why would anybody offer moderation as an option? Because you know as well as I do that a person with the wolfy voice hears that and thinks that they're going to be the one in 16 million who can have one drink a year, when we both know that isn't how people recover from addiction.
Yeah, and it's dangerous, right? Because if they're, maybe it's me, that might be the drink that gets them in a car wreck or gets them major legal consequences or marriage consequences. So for me, I offer the harm reduction or moderation or whatever we want to call it as a part of rolling with a person's resistance. And that's a term that comes from motivational interviewing. So if somebody comes in who's maybe not 100% committed, I have reached my rock bottom, I know I can never drink again, things have to change, I will do whatever you tell me, magical therapist, what do I need to do? I would tell that person, yeah, you need to stop drinking immediately, and let's figure out how to get a support system in place that will help you to not ever drink again, because that's what you want, and explore, like, if you need medication, or if meetings are good for you, or if, like, outpatient therapy, inpatient therapy, let's talk about what you need to do to get you there. But that's such a tiny percentage of the people who come in, because as you and I'm sure your listeners and readers know, like, yeah, there is that hope of, oh, well, maybe, or maybe I quit for 2 years and I can go back. And that's not realistic, and what I know about the neurobiology of addiction, it's not going to work on a physiological level. But as a clinician, my job is to meet my clients where they are. And if somebody's in a place of questioning and maybe hoping, it's like, okay, let's see how that works. I'll tell you what I recommend for you is that you stop everything completely, but a lot of people don't like that. So what do you think about using, you know, this medication along with, you know, the therapy that we're doing? And I'll give you some information. We'll see how you're doing. So, I mean, and that's where my training comes in, of meeting the client where they are and coming from a non-judgmental acceptance of where they are on the stages of change.
Yeah, I disagree with that.
I love it.
Oh my God, I'm just like, I'm struck between being a polite host and being on the other side of it, working with 2,600 people who contact me directly saying, I'd like to quit drinking, everybody who comes to me even says, I don't want to quit drinking, but my life's a misery, or I don't want to quit drinking, but I think I'll try some period of time, or I know I need to quit drinking, but I can't. Nobody comes to quitting drinking willfully.
Yeah.
But if anybody has mentioned alcohol, they already know there's an issue. So the thing is, if anybody's already saying it, they're further along than you'd think, because otherwise they're not saying anything. Because I know from years of people go to marriage counseling, but they never mention the overdrinking, or they've been fired from their job, but they never mention the two bottles of wine a night. So, you know, that's all sort of common. I think what I do that's different from what you do, and I think I would agree with meeting people where they are, but to assume that they come into your office to talk about alcohol means they're already in a place. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. Right. And they're probably, as you described, like, further along than they even realize, because there are so many defense layers get between calling it what it is.
Right. And so then I think that instead of meeting them where they are with that, I think you ignore that entirely and propose a trial instead. Instead of saying, and I'm not telling you how to do your job, I'm telling you how I do my job, and I'm interested to see where they overlap. And I'm not trying to be particularly adversarial either. I'm just trying to express. I think the idea of a trial is a missing piece, because nobody wants to quit, and nobody wants to wait for a low enough bottom so that they surrender, quote unquote. So we're all stuck in this place between those two things. Nobody wants to quit. Everybody wants to feel better, but still keep the alcohol in their life. Everybody, me included. And nobody wants to be an alcoholic. It's a bad word. Got bad connotations. So my approach, and I want you to come back at me with two fists up. My approach in that situation would be, look, you've come in here because you want to talk about drinking. Clearly, you're drinking more than you want to be, or you wouldn't be here. I'm not going to talk about moderation because, honestly, it doesn't work. And I know that your brain thinks that it might work, and it's a really interesting fantasy. It just doesn't actually work. So what I might suggest instead, though, to convince you, is a period of time off, 100% off, short trial, just to see what happens. Because lots of people can walk into a trial where they'll never walk into surrender.
I love that.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And so then, can
I
you
do? I love that.
But can you tell me then? Because I should have pre-screened you better. I'm sorry. I should have asked you about your feelings about harm reduction before I got you on the phone. Because now I feel like it's not fair.
Oh, don't worry about me. You know, like okay. So I'm a Libra. Right, so I'm just somebody who naturally sees all sides of this, and I'm a Libra counselor, so I tend to really very deeply empathize with my clients. And you know, if it was me entering, you know, sobriety, recovery, whatever you want to call it, I would go abstinence.
I think that's what everybody thinks they will do until they have to do it, and then it's just too hard.
Right, because then all of the, but I can't, and oh my gosh, and oh, this day was the worst, and oh, blah, 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 blah.
Right. So now I'm going to ask you a question, and you are going to tell me that you'd like this section cut out of the tape, and I will heed that if that's what you want. Okay. Are you an overdrinker?
I am. I do. Like here and there. And actually you've caught me on vacation with my family, and this is like the family dynamic.
Do you want this removed from the tape?
Oh no, I'm fine with it.
Okay. How does that work in terms of giving? I'm dead serious because I have a feeling about coaches and therapy and counselors, specifically on this issue of the wolfy voice, that if you don't have it, you don't get it. That if you don't have the wolfy voice, you don't get it. Like you don't know what it's like in your head. So would you say that you understand a voice that says drink now, even when that doesn't make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And so tell me then, what is the standard protocol right now? It's probably naltrexone, right?
So yeah, there's naltrexone, which is the med that will reduce the physiological cravings. And then there's antabuse, which is the one that makes you really sick if you drink on it. And so that's really easy to avoid, is you just stop taking your antabuse 3 days before your cousin's wedding.
Yeah. The problem with naltrexone, though, is that you continue to drink while you take it. So it's not helping you to quit drinking. It's allowing you to drink without some side effects and presumably helping to reduce the cravings. But do you have a success story of somebody taking naltrexone who then went on to be abstinent because of the naltrexone?
You know, I don't offhand, and you, because,
and I don't either.
Well,
I mean, anecdotally, I'm not a doctor. Yeah. I'm not a therapist. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Everybody listening to this should totally fucking ignore me, and they should be irritated that I'm irritated.
Oh, no, but I love your irritation because it is so true. But I will tell you, and this might just get me, like, you know, shunned from the therapy community, is I was working with a client who was, he came in with major high use of benzodiazepines and opiates. He said he would drink here and there, but his thing was the pills, the downers. And I educated him how deadly that is, especially if he was to be adding alcohol, which I had the sense he was underreporting. Mm-hmm. And what he did was he switched over to marijuana and was able to, I mean, like, he was smoking a ton of marijuana, but then no more of the pills. Mm-hmm. And what I know of the physiology and the science is that a person is far less likely to die from marijuana use. Now, is that ideal? No, he's still clouding his mind, and marijuana stays in the system way longer than opiates or benzos or alcohol, and so he is, you know, under the influence longer, although he doesn't think so, but I know the science. And so for me, of course, that's not a, quote, success story, but it's somebody that's still alive and has a higher level of insight into his ability to change, you know, change his own habits, and I think it moves him one step closer to being off substances altogether. And, I mean, I guess he'd be abstinent if he was dead, but I'd prefer he was stoned than dead or, like, wiped out on opiates all the time and not leaving his house.
Right. I disagree with that too.
And I totally get it.
I think the goal is to be sober because the voice that's saying I need to numb out is all the same voice. Whether we transfer it from alcohol to food to something else, it's all the same voice. Mm-hmm. I have a large number of women in my group who've had gastric bypass surgery who then go on to be overdrinkers. I don't have anybody in my, literally don't have a single person out of probably 4,000 who has a success story with naltrexone. And I have lots of success stories with an abuse because when you take it, you don't drink. And all you need to take it is some accountability.
Yes.
You email every day and say you've taken your pill, and then off you go. And it removes the choice, because the same way that some women, not all, some women can quit drinking when they're pregnant, once the choice is removed, the nattering little OCD voice stops asking. Do you see alcohol overuse on the continuum with OCD? Or how do you see addiction?
Thinking of OCD as a spectrum disorder along with alcohol use?
Seeing compulsive hand washing to be not substantially different from a voice in your head that says drink now is the same voice that says you have germs on your hands. If you just wash one more time, it'll be clean. If I just drink one more drink, it'll stop.
Ooh, you know, I'd be interested to see the brain science on that which brain structures are being activated, because I believe the OCD impulses live in the cingulate gyrus, or that, you know, close to the limbic system. And the alcohol or the drug reward pathway kind of spans all portions of the brain.
Right.
But I would say anecdotally in my work, there is a correlation between alcohol use, over drinking, and people who also have traits of obsessive compulsive disorder or perfectionism, or, you know, needing to, that element of control and things aren't right, which I think is a message from our deepest selves, our soul, the part of us that knows the life we should be living, saying, do something. But then it gets twisted through all of our layers of consciousness and culture and what's acceptable and what's not and what's too woo-woo or what doesn't fit in your religious or whatever. But I think all of us are wired and craving at a soul level to be free of the things that make us miserable.
And my experience as a person who's had this and doesn't have it anymore is, well, which isn't to say I don't have it anymore. I still have it, but I have know how to make it shut up. The only way I know to make it shut up is to not feed it at all, mm-hmm. and that it gets quieter the further away you get from it. And that if you're unable to do a 30 or 100 day trial, the issues are larger than you think they are.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us can't quit without support, but the support comes from somebody else who's already done it. And that does sort of go against what any social worker is doing, because most mm-hmm. social workers, honest, and most psychotherapists and most psychologists and most psychiatrists aren't sober people. And if they are, they're not really supposed to talk about it, right?
Exactly, right? Yeah. Totally. Like, keep those boundaries. And then I know some amazing social workers that are just out with it, and, you know, they came to becoming licensed addiction counselors because they came through recovery.
Right. Then why would you come to it? I know we need to wind up our call, so if you're not a person in recovery, why would you do this work?
Because it transforms people, and I like to see the transformation. I love working with people who are working and experiencing the magic that the combination of their will and this kind of serendipity or the grace of God, spirit, source, whatever, when you show up and want to make real change, it's possible. And I love being a part of that and giving people a space to ask those questions.
And would you do a 100-day sober trial with no alcohol, no pot, no benzos for 100 days?
Absolutely.
Starting when?
I'll start today. You want me to call you tomorrow?
Starting today, now you're on vacation, your brain will say, but there's one more thing, but there's one more party, but there's one more event.
But I just talked with you.
And I was the least gracious interview you ever had.
And I love it. It fires me up, man. I thought I was going to sit here and have a nice, you know, let's just stroke each other's egos thing. And I love it. I'm fired up. I'm ready. Let's do this.
The way it works is you commit to being sober for 100 days. You send me a daily email to confirm that you've done so. There's other resources on the site, like podcasts and calls and other things. The only thing that I know that works is to be in contact with somebody who's done it, because then you know that you're not crazy and that the noise in your head is. But I think it also makes us, at least me, more empathetic than to somebody struggling with it when we realize how hard it is to do that. It isn't just that just wanting it isn't enough. You have to come at it sideways with the trial or saying don't say alcoholic, or you have to lower the barrier to entry.
I love that.
Rather than skirting around starting.
Well, I want to tell you something a little bit personal. I hadn't planned on telling you this, but I actually did start your 100-day challenge and was somewhere in the 50s. And then my mom died. Mm. Suddenly, tragically, and that was the little foothold that Wolfie got mm-hmm. that said, okay. And then it was a return to drinking.
Right. Did you have a sober coach that you reached out to every day that you could talk to about this?
No, I'm the
counselor. Were you doing it alone in your head?
I have a sober coach.
You were doing it alone in your head, right?
Yeah. I know.
Do you know I have a psychiatrist in my group? And I mean, if you think it's difficult to reach out and get support, try being a psychiatrist. I have, you know, corporate lawyers in my group. I have people, all different kinds. I have a top author, national renowned author in my group. I couldn't do it alone, and I had what's called a high bottom, right? I mean, you know what a high bottom is, but for my audience, a high bottom is a person who hasn't had specifically large consequences, although many small, hasn't had large consequences of overdrinking, and it was still hard to quit. Because it's for most of us, it's a psychological dependence and not a physical one, thank God. Once you slip into a physical addiction, you know, God help you. Because it's like, then it's like really fucking hard. Yeah. Then you really are at medication and at harm reduction and trying to just keep yourself alive, because people then are drinking hand sanitizer because there's alcohol in it.
Oh, yes. I've heard that story so many times.
Yep. I have a first cousin who died of alcoholism at age 39. She was in rehab 10 or 15 times. She could only be sober while she was in rehab. She drank the day she came out every time, or she walked out early. The voice in her head got so loud that she could not act in her own best interest.
Oh, so tragic.
And you just think that alcohol sucks the life out of perfectly nice people who, when they raise their hand, when they're higher up on the elevator saying, you know, I think I may be overdrinking, that's the time to leap with, you know what, even if you're not an alcoholic, you just say that. Even if you're not, why don't you just try this challenge thing?
If it's not a problem, it's not a problem.
If it's not a problem, right? Then a challenge would be, like, 100 days would be easy, right?
Yeah, no, prove me wrong.
Right, and most of us
need
some support.
We'll have a party. I'll buy the cake.
Right, no, most of us need some support. And plan your 100-day treat. And that's when stuff gets sorted. That's because I think that while we're still drinking, we can't make decisions about what happens next. Because really, really, all we're thinking of is, when can I drink next?
It's so true.
Well, this is so not the way I thought this was going. How about you?
I know. I'm just feeling so grateful for, like, the personality and the drive and the conviction that you have. And man, like, you know, like the recovery community, and I don't know, like, what do you call it? Recovery? Do you call it sobriety? Do you call it abstinence? What do you call it?
I don't use the word abstinence because it makes people irritated. I say sobriety. I usually say sobriety or recovery, but again, those words are all loaded. I usually just say over drinking, which is what we did before, and then sober for now, which is what we are now. But there's some people who don't like the word sober, so they change the word. And there's some people who don't like the word wolfie, so they change the word. But I try to, you know, encourage people to find the right words. But my goal has always been, up to now anyway, to lower the barrier to entry. And I'm not beyond tricking you with a trial. I'm not beyond saying, yeah, I hear you, do this anyway.
I love it. And you know what? Like, and this is why why I reached out to you, whatever it was, many weeks ago, because you, like, your work comes from this personal force that you have, you know, like, that your program started with you doing it yourself,
right,
because
right.
you recognize the truth of it. And I absolutely fucking love that. And I think it's that force and that passion and that knowledge for you that this is what it is. And I don't need a degree. I don't need studies. I don't need some scientist to tell me. I know. I know the truth.
I can
and
at
you
least
are
articulate.
Spreading it.
I can articulate that. The inside of my head, and that it resonates with anybody else has been a gift. But it was certainly not my intent. My intent was to save myself. My intent was to save myself, not to save anybody else. It wasn't. And all I continue to do on a daily basis is to save myself, and I simply do it out loud in front of other people, and that seems to help people. And then I listen to other people while they save themselves. But there's no faith healing going on here. And there's no special talent except perhaps empowerment. And I try to use empowerment instead of anger when possible. Although a bit of anger wouldn't hurt. But
see, I would challenge you on that, Belle. I think that you are doing higher level work. And maybe calling it that feels like it might, you know, alienate some of your audience, because I know a lot of people who have, like, well-earned issues with the higher power concept, but I just feel it from you, and I'm a person of deep faith, that you, like, what you're doing and how powerfully you're doing it is not just you, that there's a force bigger than you that is guiding and inspiring even your assholery.
You know, I will only challenge that because I'm the person to whom this is happening. And I understand and I understand that everybody listening has their own perception, too, of what it is that I do and why. And the only thing I will say in my defense, and it's not defense, but the only thing I will say in my explanation of what it's like to be in my head is that, like you, it is exciting to be at the finish line when people sort shit out. For sure. That is definitely rewarding. But I also know that this is how I stay sober, and I'm not stupid. If I drift from my sober supports, I will be drinking within 4 months, and I'm 5 years sober. So I know that what I do every day, while it looks all grandly altruistic, is selfish. Because it helps me.
And that's the purest form, I think, of spirituality, is tuning into what you know in your head without any other confirmation, right? We all have this voice of divine wisdom. And it is a selfish thing when it comes to making life changes or setting boundaries, you know? And that works too, whatever you call it. Yeah, but I've just got my opinion.
I know. That there's sunshine shining out of my ass, which, you know, I will.
I'm not going that far,
okay,
Belle.
Okay, fine.
You sideswiped me. I am not anointing your ass with sunshine, think that you've got like a nice beam of light, like, you know, connected up to like a source higher than you. Now, if it extends out your asshole, that's your work. I don't know.
Oh my God, this is not the way the conversation was supposed to go at all.
I'll concede that the beam goes to your head, but I will not concede that it comes out your ass.
No, I think my husband would also agree that I'm not a genius. we have to keep reminding him. Yeah. All I know is that people seem to resonate with what I say, so I keep saying it. But then I think what I was going to clarify though about higher power, and I mean this with no disrespect. I think that I learn everything that I learn from the people who communicate with me, and mm-hmm. that I can read the spaces and I can read the tone. And so if somebody's talking this way, I can hear Wolfie, or I can hear pain, or I can hear timidity, and I can adapt my message to suit who's talking to me on any given day. Like, I'm different with each person that I talk to. But I also think that everything I've learned from the group. I learn mm-hmm. what day one is like from somebody having a day one. And I learn, if I have any wisdom, it is collected from being in communication one-on-one with 2,600 people who wanted to do this and thousands of others who've read and emailed but aren't officially pen pals.
Yeah. And I love that, because that's part of the reason that I do, or like you've just articulated what feels so true for me about doing my work as a psychologist, is I'm just a deeply flawed person who shows up. I happen to be sitting in the chair and not the couch. And then, you know, these things come out of my mouth that people think are impressive or insightful or, you know, wise. It's like, I'm just telling you what I heard from you. Mm-hmm. And I think when we connect to our truth, and that truth connects to what is capital I, capital S, true, without equivocation, right? Like, you cannot drink. That is true for people who have a problem with drinking. You cannot do it. When we are connecting with what is true, that's where this divine power that's beyond us is speaking. It's not in some dude on a mountaintop, or you don't need to meditate X amount of hours to get there. You just have to listen to people and listen with your actual ears and your heart, and you will find it because it's already there.
I'll give you that. Okay. But I want to I'll refine one other thing. I'll give you that, but I want to refine one other thing, which is to say you cannot drink puts people's backs up, makes their ears perk up. It's more empowering to say you could drink. It's just not good for you. You do what's best for you. This is better for you. You do what suits you. Being sober suits you. This is a better version of you. It's not that you can't drink. It's that you choose not to because it sucks. Sort of like giving up bacon, which of course I think is
a bad
idea.
I'm going to give you an honorary social worker degree. You've got a great voice, right? You've got the great recovery voice for like recording, you know, mindfulness stuff.
Oh,
and
not at
I
all.
Love like, your 1 minute messages. Yeah. Like, yeah, you've got like the guidance voice.
As long as I can swear, I would make a terrible social worker because I wouldn't be able to swear.
Oh, no. I swear all the fucking time.
To your clients?
Oh, yeah. They love it.
Okay, good. All right. Well, that's important. All right.
Well, I mean, so, you know, you get a gauge of what somebody's okay with and what's not.
Yeah,
I mean, you're respectful, but most of them, and I don't know, this is a whole different topic, but profanity, I think, and maybe, like, I'm 36, because I was raised like, oh, don't say bad words. But people of my generation, when we do get into the place of swearing, it's like kind of like a more authentic place. It's like, okay, the rules are gone. We can really just let loose. And that's where some magical stuff happens, too.
Yeah. And I think in the anonymity of the internet world, we can drop some of that baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes if you have a loud voice in your head that thinks that drinking is a good idea, then swearing at it can help.
Yeah. I call the voices in my head all sorts of things. Like I envision, yeah, the ones that, oh, and I've got an adult table and a kiddie table in my head. And so some of like the really loud but unhealthy voices, I say, I hear you. You have a need. Now you're going back to the kiddie table because you're not like we're having an adult conversation here.
Right.
But I'm super crazy, so that's just what I do.
That's okay. You just don't give the 3-year-old the donut in the grocery store because then God help you. All right, I have to like leave you now.
Oh well, I'm so thankful that we got to talk, and I'm just so pleasantly surprised. I'm going to be thinking about this conversation for a long time, and I'm going to email you tomorrow.
And if there is a point in the future where you decide that you don't like any part of this, and I offer this to everybody whenever I talk to them, you ask me to remove a section or remove the whole thing, no questions, no dispute. It's more important
no
that
problem.
You feel comfortable than it is for me to have content.
Oh, no, I am a fan of radical authenticity, which is kind of this like buzzword right now, but like many cliches, I think it's true. And I wouldn't put it out of my mouth into your ears if I wasn't okay with it going to thousands of people.
Okay.
Because this is what it is to be human.
The offer still stands if you have a bad moment.
Well, thank you so much. You're so gracious.
You're welcome. Okay, I'm going to leave you.
All right. You take care. Thank you so much for what you do.
Pleasure chatting with you.
You too. Bye.
Okay, goodbye. Okay, now that it's over, let me come in here with a PS. I saved this audio and did not release it for 30 days. I wanted to see how she did, and she is on day 30 today, which is why I have done the editing and put it together today. I also offered her another opportunity to retract this and to not have me share it, and she has agreed that it's okay for me to share. But I also, I wanted to, in fairness, I wanted to share it when I was sure she was sober and when she was sure she was sober, and she is. She's on day 30 today. Okay, let me leave you there.